Assalamu alaikum students. On behalf of the Ministry of Science and Technology, the Virtual University of Pakistan and Mubashir Humayun, I welcome you to another lecture in financial management. Today we are going to continue talking about the weighted average cost of capital, and we will begin talking about the concept of operating leverage. Both of these concepts are part of the new area that we started in the previous lecture, which is called capital structure. Just to review some of the concepts that we covered in the previous lecture, capital structure is the area of financial management where we decide what the distribution of debt and equity should be within a company or a firm. This is an important decision, and it is part of financial policy that is made by the board of directors and the chief executives of the companies. The job of deciding what amount of debt and equity to have is a difficult one, and one of the first things that we need to do is to calculate what the cost of capital is going to be. So a company has the option of raising money or capital either from the debt market or money market or from the capital market in the form of equity. Now, you might think that the equity that a company raises has no cost. We all know that whenever a company takes a loan from a bank, it has to pay a cost, and that is the interest or markup. But oftentimes people think that when a company raises money from the stock market, that there is no cost attached to it because they are not paying any fixed regular interest. But that is a mistake, because in fact there is a cost for raising equity, and that is the required rate of return that your stockholders expect to receive in the form of dividends. If the company does not pay that over a period of time, then the stockholders will sell those shares and the price of the share will go down. So this is why it is important to be able to estimate not just the cost of debt in the form of interest, but also the cost of equity. And in the previous lecture, we started talking about the computation of the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC, and we mentioned that we need to calculate the cost of debt separately from the cost of preferred stock and separately from the cost of common equity. Now, we have already discussed how to calculate the required rate of returns for debt or bonds and the required rate of returns for preferred equity and for common equity. Several lectures back, we went through the bond pricing formula, which allows us to calculate the bond price. And if we know the bond price, then we can solve that equation for R. And that R is the required rate of return for investing in the bond or debt. Similarly, we came up with the Gordon's formula for calculating the fair price of a stock, and we can rearrange the same formula and solve it for the variable R, which will allow us to calculate the required rate of return for a stock. Then we mentioned that there is a slight difference between the required rate of return that we calculated in the earlier part of this course and the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC. WACC takes into account practical considerations like taxes and transaction costs for floating or issuing the security in the open market. Now, let us put together all of the different costs for debt, preferred stock, and equity that we calculated in the previous lecture and combine them into the overall weighted average cost of capital for a company that has raised capital in all three different ways. So let us take the example of a company ABC, and that company has equal amounts of debt preferred stock and common equity, one third each. In the previous lecture, we calculated what the cost of debt for this company was. That was 11.2%. We calculated what the cost of preferred capital was, and that was 16.7%. And we also calculated the cost of common equity capital for this company, and that was 22.7%. So that was the most difficult part of the WACC calculation. Now it is easy because we just have to apply the weightages or the percent of the capital that has been invested in each one of these different forms to calculate the overall weighted average cost of capital for this firm. So if you take a look at the slide, let us do that computation. You will see that the weighted average cost of capital for a company that has equal amounts of debt, preferred stock and common stock at the required rate of returns that were mentioned is as follows. The WACC is equal to RDXD plus REXE plus RPXP. And that is equal to 11.2% times one-third plus 16.7% times one-third plus 22.7% times one-third. That is equal to 16.9%. Now, we've just calculated that the overall weighted average cost of capital for a company that is using all three different types of capital, debt, preferred stock and common equity, has come out to be 16.9%. Well, what does this mean? It's very important to be able to interpret your answers. This means that this company, ABC, has an average cost of capital of 16.9%. This is how much it's costing for this company to use the capital of investors, bond investors or debt investors, preferred stock investors and common equity investors. This is the average of all the costs that they have to pay to each one of these investors. Now, this means that any project or investment that this company makes should generate a rate of return which is higher than 16.9%. In other words, what the weighted average cost of capital tells us is that whatever new investment that you make must be higher than the weighted average cost of capital, otherwise you're not making enough money to cover the costs that you have to pay to your investors. It's very simple. So, whatever projects and investments that this company will invest its income or cash in have to give a return which is higher than the WACC. And next we're going to take a look at a graph of the weighted average cost of capital compared to the security market line that we came up with in the capital asset pricing theory. And this is a very important graph. I'd like you to understand it well because it combines the market factors in the form of the security market line as well as the company's internal costs in the form of the weighted average cost of capital. And it graphically and visually tells you what combinations of risk and return will be acceptable for a particular company to invest in or not. So let's take a look at this slide. If you take a look at the slide, you'll see a combined representation of the capital asset pricing model as well as the weighted average cost of capital model. The graph shows the expected return against the market risk or beta. The upward sloping line represents the security market line from the capital asset pricing theory. And this is the requirement for securities. In other words, this is the requirement for bonds and stocks in efficient markets. In efficient markets where there are rational investors that are maintaining fully diversified portfolios, and where knowledge spreads very quickly throughout the market, the risk and return combinations of all securities should lie on this straight line. And we talked about this in detail earlier. Now, the horizontal flat line that you see on the graph is the weighted average cost of capital. And that is fixed at 16.9% that we just calculated. It's based on the capital structure for our company ABC. And this represents this company or firm's required return. In other words, that if this company is going to make any new investments in any real project or any bond or any stock, then that investment must give a rate of return that is higher than 16.9%. Now look at this graph carefully and you'll see that the only feasible region where this company will make investments is the area which I have shown filled up with dots, and that is the area of this graph which is higher than both the SML line and also higher than the WACC line. I've also shown three crosses on this graph which represent why the company will not invest in those regions. The first cross, cross number one on the right hand side, represents a point that is higher than the WACC but lower than the SML. The company will not invest at this point because even though at this point a particular investment is giving a return which is higher than the WACC, that return is not as high as the market, the efficient market, is offering. The second cross in the center, cross number two, is a point which represents an investment which is giving a rate of return which is lower than the WACC and lower than the SML. So clearly, the company will not invest in any such project or investment. And finally, cross number three on the left-hand side represents a case where an investment is offering a rate of return which is higher than the efficient market or SML, but it is lower than the WACC for this company. So again, the company will not invest in this investment because it is offering a rate of return which is lower than its cost of capital. Therefore, the only region where this company will choose to invest is that feasible region which has been shown with the dots. Now, let us shift our attention to the important concept of capital structure, which we introduced a couple of lectures back. Remember that I mentioned that generally speaking, companies prefer to keep a balance of both equity and debt in the form of capital. I'd also mentioned that debt has associated with it a certain amount of risk, because when you take a loan or when you take debt, then you have to service regular and fixed interest or markup. And this interest or markup eats away at your income. So there is a greater chance that you might make a net loss because of these fixed interest payments. When you take a look at the income statement or P&L, you'll see that the financial charges are deducted from the operating income. Therefore, if the operating income of the company drops because of certain larger economic forces or because of a company-specific problem, then the company might make a loss because it has to service the debt. Another reason is that if the company does not pay the interest or markup, then it can be forced to close down by law. So there is a risk attached to debt. So then why do companies take on debt? And there are various reasons for this. One of the reasons is that by taking debt instead of equity, the company does not have to share its profits with the investors. debt holders or investors who have invested in the company in the form of debt do not demand a percent share of the net income the way the equity investors do. Debt holders simply require a certain amount of fixed interest to be paid regularly and on time. That's one advantage of debt. Another advantage of debt is that it has a limited life. So the company does not have to pay the investors who have invested in the debt of this company forever. Equity holders have to be paid for as long as the company is alive. But debt holders only need to be paid the interest for the duration of the loan. A third advantage of debt is that the interest payments associated with debt are tax deductible. You don't have to pay tax on the interest that you pay to your debt holders. So this is a tax saving that is associated when you raise capital in the form of debt. And finally, something that we will talk about in greater detail in this lecture and the next is that when a company takes capital in the form of debt, it can increase the return on equity or ROE for the company and for the common equity holders or the common stockholders. And ROE is a very important financial ratio that we mentioned very early on in this course. And when a company takes on debt, or in other words, when a company takes on leverage, then it can improve or increase its ROE. So these are some of the reasons why companies choose to take on debt, even though it adds to the risk of the company. So now let's talk about the risk faced by a firm or a company. You will recall that in the previous part of this course, when we were studying risk and return and portfolio theory and capital asset pricing model, we focused our attention on the security. And specifically, we focused our attention on the stock, which is a piece of paper that represents ownership in the company. But now we want to look at risk from the point of view of the company as a whole. And there are certain similarities and certain differences. First of all, let's review our concept of standalone risk for a stock. We talked about this earlier. The standalone risk for a stock has two components. It's equal to the diversifiable or company-specific risk plus the market risk. And we mentioned when we were talking about portfolio theory that it's possible that if you make several investments, perhaps as many as 40 uncorrelated investments, that you can virtually eliminate the company-specific or diversifiable portion of this risk. And then the only risk that remains is the market risk associated with the larger economy of the country and the macroeconomic variables. Now that was the risk associated with a stock. And we made this division because in the capital asset pricing model, we were trying to associate and make a relationship between the market risk or beta and the required rate of return. So that's why our perspective was to divide risk between the diversifiable risk, which is company specific, and the market risk. Now, we are looking at the entire company or firm. And we are looking at the entire firm from the point of view of capital structure. How much debt and how much equity should a company maintain, which will minimize its cost and be best for the company? So, when we talk about the risk faced by a firm, then that standalone risk has two components. The standalone risk for a firm is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. And why have we made this division? Because in the business risk, we will look at all risk that is associated with the assets and the operations of a business other than debt. In business risk, we will assume that the firm has no debt. And we will look only at the factors and the sources of risk that arise from the assets and the operations of the business. Now, this business risk, of course, has a company-specific portion, which is concerned with the internal operations of the company, as well as a market component. Why? Because the business risk of a company is affected also by the larger market forces of the country, the politics, the economy, and global forces around the world. That is the business risk. The other component of a company's risk is the financial risk. And in the financial risk, we will just focus our attention on the risk, the additional risk that is created by debt. So this is the pure financial or debt-related risk. So again, when we talk about the risk of a firm or a company, then that standalone risk is equal to the business risk plus the financial risk. Now, let us talk about the financial risk faced by a firm. What creates financial risk? Well, we mentioned that when a company takes on debt, the financial risk of the company goes up. And why is that? Well, supposing that a company has zero debt and that its capital is 100% equity. Now, in this case, let us assume that the risk of this company is measured by the standard deviation of the earnings of this company. The standard deviation of the earnings of this company, let's say, is 10%. This company has 100% equity, and let us suppose that this equity is represented in the form of 100 shares that are owned by various people who are the owners of this company. Now the company decides to reduce the equity to one half and instead to replace the half of the equity by debt. So, the company will buy back 50 shares and replace them by debt. Now, what has happened? Now, there are only 50 shares in the market, but the risk or standard deviation of the business and of the earnings of the business is still 10%. So what we see is that that same risk now is distributed across a fewer number of shares. So the risk of the company per share or per common equity has gone up. And this is what happens when a company takes on debt. When a company increases its debt, then the risk shifts onto the common stockholders, and they have to bear a larger portion of the risk. They have to bear a larger burden of the risk. Why? Because the risk of the company and the operations is still at least the same as it was before, but the number of shareholders and the amount of equity is now less. Why don't the debt holders share the risk? Well, they do, but that risk that they share is very, very small. There's hardly any risk for a bank or for a bondholder, because they are legally protected. They have the first claim on the assets in case the company closes down. Number one. Number two, their interest and markup is fixed and regular. So they don't bear a very large risk at all. They have a very, very small portion of the risk. Most of the risk is borne by the common stockholders. So, naturally, when a company decides it is going to take on debt, then the common stockholders realize that the risk to them is going up. So they won't just sit idly and face this. They will demand a higher required rate of return. When the common stockholders or shareholders of a company find out that the company is taking on more loans or debt, they will demand a higher required rate of return, which means that they will expect higher dividends. So, what do we mean by the risk exactly? I mentioned that we can measure the risk faced by a company or a firm in terms of the standard deviation. Now, you will recall that when we were talking about stocks in the portfolio theory, that we talked about risk in terms of the uncertainty or the fluctuation in the rate of return. That was the rate of return for the stock. And we can calculate the rate of return for a stock using Gordon's formula. Now, when we are talking about entire companies or firms, what rate of return should we pick? Well, financial accounting provides us with a couple of ratios that we can use as representative measures of the overall return for a company. And one of those ratios is the return on assets. So when we talk about the risk faced by a company or a firm, we will talk about the uncertainty or the fluctuation or the spread or volatility in the return on assets. What was the formula for the return on assets? Quite simply, that was equal to the total return to the investors divided by the total assets of the company. The total return to the investors is equal to the return to the stockholders plus the return to the debt holders. Remember that debt holders are also investors. The debt holders have invested in your debt, and the stockholders have invested in your equity. So we have to take both into account. The total return is the return to the stockholders plus the return to the debt holders. The return to the stockholders is represented by the net income from the profit and loss statement, and the return to the debt holders is represented by the interest payment or the combined interest and principal reserviced, and that also appears in the profit and loss statement. So the return on assets, or ROA, is equal to the total return to the investors divided by the total assets, which is equal to the net income for the year plus the interest payment for the year divided by the total assets. And just to refresh your memory from financial accounting, the total assets, which is one side of the balance sheet, is equal to the total liabilities, which is the other side of the balance sheet. And the total liabilities is, broadly speaking, equal to the total debt plus the total equity. So please remember these basic formulas, because they will be useful when we talk about capital structure and leverage later on. Now, this was a case of a company that has both debt and equity. If a company only has equity capital, or if it is 100% equity and no debt, then the overall rate of return of the company becomes more simplified. Now the ROA is equal to simply the net income divided by the total assets. There is no interest to be paid. So in the numerator, we only have the net income term. The ROA for a 100% equity company then is equal to the net income divided by the total assets. But the total assets of a 100% equity firm is equal to the equity. Because you will remember that the total assets is equal to debt plus equity. There's no debt for a 100% equity company. Therefore, the overall return of a 100% equity company is equal to the net income divided by the total equity. And that happens to equal to the return on equity, or ROE. So for the case of a 100% equity company, we will choose the ROE, or return on equity, as a representative measure of the return of the company. And when we talk about the risk associated with a 100% equity company, we will focus on the uncertainty or variation or spread or changes in the ROE. The ROE changes are also representative of what we mentioned earlier, which was the basic business risk faced by a company. Now, we spoke about the business risk separate from the financial risk. We said that the standalone risk of a firm or a company is equal to the business risk from the operations and assets plus the financial risk from debt. Now, what are some of the causes or factors for the basic business risk that is faced by a firm? There are many, many factors, and I will go through some of them. If we measure the business risk by the uncertainty or variation or standard deviation in the ROE, or the return on equity of a company, then it can be caused by many, many factors. One of them is the variation in the customer demand for the product or service of the company. Another one is the variation or uncertainty in the price of the finished product of the company, or in the price of the raw materials and inputs that a company buys. Changes and fluctuations in prices and costs will lead to changes and fluctuations in the earnings or the net income, which will lead to fluctuations or changes in the ROE. It's that simple. Another reason for business risk is that the management may have been unable to implement effective stabilization policies. So the job of the management and the objective of good management is to maintain steady operations and steady growth, and if the management has been unable to do that, then it would lead to a certain amount of business risk. Now, this can be caused by ineffective price stabilization, where the management is unable to control the price changes in the product and the raw materials, and it can also be caused by inability to control the product development or service costs. The causes for business risk are many, and the final one that I want to mention here is the high operating leverage. Operating leverage is a concept that... So the final cause of high business risk that I'd like to mention at this point is high operating leverage. And we will discuss this concept in greater detail right now. But the higher the operating leverage of a company, the greater the business risk. Now let's talk about what operating leverage is. Leverage is a term that is used in English to describe many things. Leverage is a concept that is also used in physics. In fact, there is a very famous statement made by an ancient Greek scientist and philosopher who said that, "Give me a lever long enough and I will move the earth." Leverage is something which allows a small force to create a large effect. It is said that the leaders, charismatic leaders of countries, presidents and prime ministers, the governors of central banks of countries, and chief economists have leverage in their spoken word. So even a small sentence by these leaders can lead to a very, very important consequence in the economy or in the sociopolitics of a country. That is the concept of leverage. How a small thing can cause a very, very large effect. When we talk about the concept of operating leverage in financial management, then we are talking about the effect that a small change in the quantity of sales or the amount of product that a company sells can have on the earnings of a company. Operating leverage, or OL, is defined as the fixed costs divided by the total costs. And for this, you need to go back to your financial accounting text and your microeconomics. The operating leverage, if, for example, the total cost is 100 rupees and the fixed cost is 50 rupees, then the operating leverage is equal to 50 divided by 100, which is equal to 50%, or 0.5. So an operating leverage of 0.5 or 50% is generally considered to be a high operating leverage. And a company with an operating leverage of 50% is considered to be quite risky. Why? Simply because if the customer demand and the sales of this company drop, then the fixed costs of the company will still remain very high, because fixed costs are fixed. They don't decrease with a decrease in output or in the decrease in sales. And if the sales have dropped but the costs are still high, then there is a greater chance that the company will make operational losses. Therefore, companies that have high operating leverage are generally considered to be more risky. Now, the operating leverage is something that is not entirely in the control of a company. There are certain companies in certain industries that have to have high operating leverage. Operating leverage here, again, means that there is a high percentage of fixed costs. For example, when we talk about capital-intensive industries like the power sector, power plants, cement plants, and textile mills, then generally speaking, these industries have a high operating leverage. There's a high percentage of fixed costs as a fraction of the total costs in these industries. There are other types of industries where the cost of new product development and research and development are very high. For example, the pharmaceutical sector and the automobile sector and the IT or technology sector. And finally, you can also have the case of an industry where you have very, very highly specialized and skilled people, such as in the IT and technology industry. And these people too constitute a fixed cost, because It's not easy to fire these people if the sales are down. Companies have to retain good people and skilled people even when their sales revenue has dropped, simply because it is difficult to find skilled people. So sometimes companies and industries are forced to maintain a high percentage of fixed costs and high operating leverage, and they're prone to higher risk. Now, let's talk about the impact of operating leverage on the capital budgeting decisions that we spoke about very early on in this course. And then after that, we will talk about the impact of operating leverage on the capital structure, which we are talking about now. So in order to take a look at the impact of operating leverage on the capital budgeting, let's take the example of the cement industry. And let us suppose that if you are interested in setting up a cement plant, that you have two options for technologies. One option is known as the wet process, which is the older technology that was used. And the second option is the dry process, and that is the newer technology. These two technologies have different operating leverages associated with them. In other words, there's a different percentage of fixed cost to total costs for these two technologies. Now, what effect will a difference in operating leverage have on the capital budgeting decision? You will remember that capital budgeting was about deciding what the best investments to make are, and we used the net present value formula as the basis and the best criteria for our investment decisions. The NPV formula uses a discount rate R, and that R is a required rate of return. And that R is linked to risk, as we learned in the capital asset pricing model. So, if we say that the operating leverage is higher for one technology, that means that the risk associated with that technology is also higher. And if the risk associated with that technology is higher, then the required rate of return or the discount rate will also become higher. So when we are calculating its NPV, we would have to use a higher discount rate. And that will bring down the NPV value for a project, for a technology that has a higher operating leverage. Operating leverage is an important concept that we need to discuss in detail, both graphically and visually, understand operating leverage, its impact on break-even, and its impact on the operating revenues and costs of a firm. After that, we will go into the concept of financial leverage and then capital structuring. Let me stop the new content for this lecture right here, and let us go over some of the concepts regarding weighted average cost of capital, debt, business risk, return on assets, and operating leverage that we have spoken about. So we began this lecture talking about the combined weighted average cost of capital for a firm that has taken capital in three forms: debt, preferred stock, and common equity. We mentioned that the formula for WACC is equal to RDXD plus RPXP plus REXE. And here the R is the cost associated with each of the forms of capital, which we learned to calculate in the previous lecture. And X is the fraction of the total capital that has been raised in the form of this particular debt or equity. The WACC gives you an answer in the form of a percentage, and we mentioned that there's a very important graph that you need to understand, which combines the WACC concept along with the concept of the security market line from the capital asset pricing theory. And when you take a look at this graph, it shows you which projects a firm can undertake or invest in. Firms will only invest and undertake those projects and investments where the rate of return and risk combination is higher than the WACC, or weighted average cost of capital, and also higher than or equal to the security market line, which represents the risk and return combinations that are available in efficient markets. We then spoke about the reason why businesses choose to raise capital in the form of debt. There are certain advantages. Debt has a limited amount of money that needs to be paid in the form of interest to the debt holders. The life of debt is limited. There are tax savings associated with interest payments. And taking debt gives the company the opportunity to increase its ROE, or return on equity, for the shareholders. We mentioned that the business faces risk. Just as we spoke about risk for a stock, in the case of a standalone stock, the risk is equal to the diversifiable risk plus the market risk. Similarly, when we talk about the risk faced by a business or a firm, then our perspective is slightly different because it's focused on capital structure. So the standalone risk of a firm is equal to the business risk from operations and the assets plus the financial risk from debt. We spoke about some of the ways in which you can measure the risk or the business risk associated with any firm or company. Just as you used the rate of return and the uncertainty or variation or standard deviation in the rate of return to measure the risk of a stock, similarly, you can use the changes or the variation in the overall return of a company to measure the risk of a company. And what financial ratio do we pick? We choose the return on assets, which is equal to the total return to the investors divided by the total assets. That is equal to the net income plus interest divided by the debt plus equity. Keep in mind that the total assets is equal to total liabilities, which is equal to debt plus equity. Now, in the case of a firm that is 100% equity, the formula gets simplified because the overall return of this company is equal to the net income divided by the total equity, which is equal to the ROE, or return on equity. So, we're in a position to measure the risk of a company using the ROE ratio, or return on equity. Towards the end of this lecture, we introduced the concept of operating leverage. Leverage is a very important concept. It means that a small change in one thing can lead to a large change in something else. In the case of operating leverage, it means that a small change in the sales for a company can lead to a large change in the return on equity, or ROE. And this can be risky because a small decline in the sales can lead to a large decline in the ROE. The operating leverage is defined as the fixed cost divided by the total costs. And certain industries that are capital intensive and have highly skilled labor have higher operating leverages than other companies and industries. So operating leverage, if it is higher, that means that the business risk is also higher, generally speaking, because the chances of operating losses are more because the company has higher fixed costs, which will remain high whether or not the sales are high or low. We will continue our discussion of operating leverage and financial leverage in the following lecture. I thank you for your attention and patience. Aapko Ministry of Science and Technology, Pakistan, Virtual University, aur Mubashir Humayun ki taraf se bahut bahut shukriya. Khuda hafiz aur assalamu alaikum.